All right.
Let me start by reviewing stuff we did towards the end of last time and then go on to some new stuff. And one of the interesting issues, which we would like an economic explanation of as economists, is the enormous increase in out-of-wedlock births, not only in the U.S. and not only people on welfare, but pretty widely in the U.S., Western Europe, and I suspect New Zealand and Australia, though I don't really know. And although I think it's, at least in the U.S., it's more common among poor people than not poor people, it isn't limited to poor people. And then the puzzle is why. And the sort of very simple economic explanation, you know, sort of supply-demand one, is if you have a welfare system where if you have a baby, we'll give you some money, that's an incentive to have babies, or at least it reduces the incentive not to have babies. That one of the things I've noticed, one of the advantages of arguing with people online, is that you can often figure out why what seems like a convincing argument to you doesn't persuade them. And one of the things I learned doing that is that when you make the argument I've just made, the non-economist hears that as people are having babies in order to make money. But what the economist is saying is not that. What the economist is saying is that a woman deciding whether to have a baby who doesn't have a husband is balancing a whole bunch of costs and benefits. That, you know, it's nice having a small person who loves you. It'll be nice growing up having kids. On the other hand, children are an awful lot of work. They cost money, various things of that sort. Anything that either reduces a cost or increases a benefit is going to push some people over the edge from on net it's not worth doing to on net it's worth doing, and therefore increases the number of people who do it. And that's true not just for the decision to have babies. It's true if you think about tax evasion, say, that why do people evade, either legally or illegally, taxes? When the tax was 45%, the risks and costs and trouble involved in getting my income in non-taxable forms or in lying about my income were high enough so I didn't do it, raise it up to 60%, and now it's worth doing it. It's the same thing. It isn't that the extra 15% is the reason for doing it, it's that the extra weight on the scale that makes it go one way instead of the other. So, different way of putting it is that non-economists often imagine that economists have a unicausal model, that they're thinking one thing determines it. Whereas the real model is, it's one-dimensional in one sense, but it's one-dimensional with lots of causes. It's rather you look at the sum of benefits of doing something to you and the sum of costs, and if the benefits are larger than the costs, but that'll include lots of different costs and benefits. All right. Anyway, enough on that point, but it's, I think, a useful general point. And so, as I say, welfare might explain some of it, but I don't think it's adequate, as far as I can tell, to explain everything happening. Another possibility might be a shift in the gender ratio. This is an interesting case of sort of economists and non-economists seeing things the opposite ways. I remember a conversation at University of Chicago Law School with somebody, I don't have no idea who anymore, on the effects of sex selection. The fact that we're getting increasingly able to decide whether to have a son or a daughter. And there is an old technology which works with 100% reliability, and that's infanticide. But the newer one for both sex selection and other things is selective abortion, because you can use amniocentesis to identify both gender and some potential birth defects early. But we can now do even better than that. I gather I am going to have a granddaughter. And the reason I'm going to have a granddaughter is that my son and his wife have just gone through the process of producing a bunch of fertilized eggs, which a host mother is going to incubate, because my daughter-in-law bore her son like I think about 3 months premature, and they're worried about that happening again, which is sort of risky and a lot of problems. And they know, because you can select it at that point, that they've got one that's female. My understanding. And there are a number of other processes that you can do sex selection. You can centrifuge sperm, and the X ones and the Y ones separate imperfectly, but you can get up to about 70% or 80% by centrifuging sperm and then using artificial insemination. So the question is, what are the consequences? And that's sort of an interesting question. It's the world we're going to be living in. Currently, I think India's got about 110 boy babies for every 100 girl babies, and China, some estimates, are about 120. In Chinese case, it's probably because of the one child for family rule, but even without that in India, there was apparently enough of a preference for sons to have some effect. And the person I was talking to said, well, the result will be that women will be oppressed because they'll be outnumbered. And my result was, no, it's the other way around. The result is that women will be, in the catbird seat, women will be the ones, there's some phrase I'm forgetting, but basically the ones who've got the scarcer resource, and therefore they get better terms in marriage because the men will be bidding for them. So you could imagine that if it's surely one thing that's happened over the last 100, 200 years is a drastic reduction in deaths and childbirth in the developed world, that ought to raise the ratio of women to men. In the 20th century, although fortunately not recently, you've had some horrendously big wars by historical standards, that since wars tend more to kill men than women, although modern wars kill both. That ought to shift the same way. So maybe what's happened is just that the women found that there were too many women and too few men, and so some of them had to settle for having kids without a husband. But I don't think, at least, that for the U.S. that's a very big effect. I think the figure for the U.S. now is there are more women than men, although that tends to be concentrated in the high age groups because women have longer life expectancies. And there is this argument that there's a brief period in the 60s when, if I had only realized it, I was in a wonderful bargaining position, having been born in 1945. But unfortunately, I didn't see this argument until long after I was off that particular market. But anyway, and then a final explanation is just rising income, that kids are expensive, but you can put up with that a good deal easier if you don't have to work 12 hours a day in order to get food and shelter for yourself. So those are all possible explanations. The neat explanation, though, is the one that Akerlof and Yellen came up with, because that's one in which, just as the point I was making before, when you apply economics to the situation, you get just the opposite of the sort of intuitive result. And I always like those cases, and I like them partly for teaching, because one of the problems in teaching is that if people already believe what you're saying before you start saying it, they don't pay any attention to the reasons, to the argument. Whereas if you say, therefore, something is obvious to you is clearly wrong. Now that's an incentive for them to try either to find the fault in your argument or to try to understand it to change their mind. So the argument Akerlof and Yellen make is that the availability of contraception and abortion, rather than decreasing the number of unmarried births, increased it. And that depends on assuming that unmarried births are largely wanted, not unwanted, which is contrary to what at least the rhetoric assumed when people were arguing in favor of legalized abortion and legalized contraception and such. And the argument then is that those technologies essentially make it easier for men to get sex without commitment, because it means that there are a bunch of women, the ones who at the moment don't want children, who also like sex and therefore are willing to sleep with you without a wedding ring or engagement ring or anything. And that means that those women who do want children are in a weaker bargaining position, whereas it used to be the case that even the women who didn't want children were likely to get them if they had sex, and therefore were only willing to have sex if there was, most of them at least, if there was either a marriage or a commitment to marriage or something of that sort. And I think that's really quite, I don't know if it's right or not, but I think it's really a neat argument because it shows how a change can have the opposite of what you would think is the effect. And it does so by replacing the sort of non-economist model of people just do things and things happen with an economist model of people who are engaged in rational choice and doing what's in their interest and so forth. All right, so we did that before, but I wanted to run through again. Next one is this argument by Peggy, whose last name I keep forgetting, and that's the argument that what caused the increasing popularity of the custom of giving expensive engagement rings in the U.S. was the abolition of the action for breach of promise to marry. That essentially, why do you care whether the promise to marry is binding? Because men and women want to have sex, and they'd like to have sex perhaps with imperfect forms of contraception prior to marriage. And that's fine if your backstop, given the unavailability of abortion, the backstop of your contraception fails, you get married, all right? So you get married, 6 months earlier than you were planning to. Not a bad system. And there's evidence that it was a very, very common system 100 years ago. As I mentioned, there's some figures from some European cities around 1900 suggesting about a third of brides were pregnant. And then the risk, if you can't enforce the promise, is seduce and abandonment. The man may say, well, I enjoyed the sex very much, but I don't really want to have the burden of bringing up a family quite yet, so goodbye. And you can then see the engagement ring as a performance bond, a way in which the man, when the law will no longer enforce the promise, the man gives a bond to enforce it. And that, by the way, is also a much more, a very general issue, that in a sense, you want to think not of legal enforcement as the only way in which you enforce contracts. It's one of a multitude of different ways. We discussed that earlier. And really, the performance bond fits into the arguments that I make about, you know, China to cyberspace stuff, about how do you construct contracts that people will choose not to violate them. Make a big payment at the front end, in this case, is how you do it. That, in effect, if you think about that America 50 or 60 years ago, the woman having sex, if she isn't sure of marriage, is bearing a large cost because being a virgin considerably increases her ability to get a husband, being believed to be a virgin, really. And especially if she gets pregnant, she obviously isn't. Even if she doesn't get pregnant, it may, you know, her jilted ex may spread rumors in the locker room or something. And therefore, he has to make a balancing payment, as it were, in order that it won't, at that point in the contract, pay him to walk out on. So that's sort of a neat argument. And as I say, the evidence for it really was the pattern of diamond sales. The diamond sales apparently went up at the point when the state after state was abandoning this action, and a good deal later declined. That's what I remember. I think I've probably got the site for the article in my book, and I've probably got a link to it. As you may know, the webbed version of the book, all of the icons in Law's Order are links in the webbed version, so that lets you follow out. I've probably got a link to the article. I don't swear I do, but the sort of thing I usually do. All right. I then had my bit on seduction law, which, as far as I know, I'm the only person who's noticed, and I've never written it up except in the context of teaching this stuff. But, and I'm not sure it's right, but it was sort of an odd rule that you get to sue for the seduction of your daughter on the theory that you're a master and she's a servant, and there's a legal doctrine where the employer, in effect, can sue for the cost to him of injury to a servant. And the legal explanation is she can't sue because she's a party to a criminal act, namely fornication. And I was offering the social conjecture that it's partly a way of putting the power in the father's hand rather than the daughter's, because daughters may choose to let themselves be seduced as a way of forcing their fathers to give permission for them to marry the man they want. Not sure it's right, but I thought it was an interesting conjecture. We then went on to the general issue of law, sex, and the markets, and the question of why it's illegal for adoptive parents to pay the mother. Why do people have a strong gut feeling against baby sales, as they put it? Similar questions with regard to prostitution. And I argued a more general puzzle about why in certain contexts we think of money as taboo, as sort of unclean, with the examples that I have here. In the case of prostitution, one argument which I think has gotten attention mostly only from law professors is Margaret Radin's argument, which is that certain transactions change, my transaction with someone else changes the way a third person thinks. And that's at least how I would interpret the commodification argument, that you say, if we allow men to pay women for sex, that will make people think of sex as a sort of a commercial transaction between a man and a woman. That will undermine marriage, courtship, and stuff like that. And it's not logically impossible. I find it unconvincing. My impression is that even men who have sex with prostitutes regard that as very much a second best alternative. What they really want to do is to find a woman who's in love with them and who they're in love with and will therefore want to have sex with them. But since they haven't managed that, this is the best they can do. So I don't think it's really true empirically, but what strikes me about it legally is that it really, it seems to me, amounts to criminalizing speech, because the argument is that the reason why it might make sense to have laws against prostitution is to keep me from taking an act, which act is also unintentionally a speech about the nature of sex, which then affects you, and normally our legal system doesn't let you criminalize that stuff. I should say, to be fair to Radin, I think in the article I'm thinking of, she doesn't come out for prostitution being illegal. What she says is, here is an argument for its being illegal. She recognizes there are arguments on the other side. All right, any questions on this stuff so far? Wait a minute. It occurs to me, I was just thinking that I'd added something to that, and then noticing that something I'd added wasn't there, and the reason it wasn't there is that it's on my flash disk, and I haven't transferred it yet to this machine. So let me very briefly interrupt this to because I remember that I had added something that I thought was interesting to this particular point about an hour ago when I was going over my notes, and there may be a couple of other such things, and therefore let's get the very latest version. And what I added was we can't sell babies, supposedly, and yet, to the best of my knowledge, it is legal to sell eggs. I think it's legal to sell sperm, and as far as I know, it's legal to sell fertilized eggs. So, a fertilized egg is really a baby. I mean, it's just, minus 9 months. Are there good reasons for feeling differently? And I was thinking about that because, as I was saying, my adult son and his wife are in the process of doing a host mother, just arranged host mother arrangement to provide me with a granddaughter. And as is typically the case, this produces excess fertilized eggs because the process... And they intend, I gather, to either sell or give away the excess fertilized eggs. And my son's view is that, as a good believer in evolutionary biology, he thinks that spreading his genes is what he's out here to do, and therefore this is a great way of doing it. And I have exactly the opposite reaction. That is to say, I would be very reluctant to donate sperm to a sperm bank. And the reasons are emotional, not economic. And the reason in my case is that I think of my children as people I have a special link to and especially responsible for, and I don't want random parents to be raising my children, so to speak. And so apparently he doesn't share that view. And I should discuss it with him. I haven't, actually. But it struck me as another interesting point. But anyway, as I say, that's where we were. All right, let me now go to what I guess is sort of one of the major things I wanted to discuss today, and that's this argument, which was very, very popular back when I was in college and a little after, that the ills of the world are due to overpopulation. As you may know, there were people making some very sharp predictions, essentially world famine in the 1970s with, a large fraction of the world population dying, which prediction turned out to be entirely false. Per capita food production in poor countries has trended up from then to now, pretty much. And people wanted to do things, and of course China did do something, as we know. And India made some effort until it became politically unacceptable. So from an economist standpoint, what's the argument on population control? And the basic argument is that when I have a child, that results in various costs and benefits, but the claim is it imposes costs on other people. And if that's right, then our standard analysis of externalities says I will be too willing to have children, everybody else will be too willing to have children, and we'll have a greater than optimal population. Now, to begin with, there is a very hard sort of conceptual issue here, which I am going to skip over, and if you're sufficiently curious, I've got a published article on it you could look at. And that is, what do we mean by an optimal population? Because after all of our economic efficiency stuff so far has taken the number of people as fixed. We've said, given that people are out there, how much would it be worth to you to have this outcome? How much would it be worth to you to not have this outcome? But now, how much is it worth to me to exist? Because we're considering, if we're imagining different population policies, we're considering alternative futures, some of which have people in them that don't exist in the other one. Well, how do we count the benefits to those people in deciding what's an improvement or a worsening? Any suggestions? If we're trying to create a conceptual criterion for when we have the right population size, how would you do it? What? I don't know what that means.
Everyone has adequate food and shelter.
I don't know what adequate means. Did people have adequate food and shelter 300 years ago? Most of them lived. How about 100 years ago? How 10 years ago? I don't think those are meaningful concepts. That having more medical care is better, up to spending the whole GNP on medical care. Having better quality food. I mean, I like really good, you know, good French cooking is really nice stuff. But if everybody had it all the time, we wouldn't have anything else. So turning it the other way, estimates have been done on the cost of a minimum cost full nutrition diet. If all you care about is nutrition and not taste, and it turns out to be extraordinarily cheap. I mean, you're talking about, I don't know what it is nowadays, $2 a day, $1 a day, that kind of scale. And it's, you know, soybeans and lentils and dried milk and, you know, stuff like that, which gets you your protein and whatever else you need at very low cost. If you're ever curious, actually, it's sort of fun, go into a grocery store, start with a number of calories, whatever you believe. Let's say, I think 2,000 calories is standard adult. And you just say, how much would it cost to get 2,000 calories of lentils? How much would it cost to get 2,000 calories of dried milk? How much would it cost to get 2,000 calories of the cheapest vegetable oil I can find? All right. If you think about sort of what are the main things you need are fat, protein, and carbohydrate. So figure out a high-fat, cheap source of nutrition, a high-protein, cheap source of nutrition, a high-carbohydrate one. The minimum cost of getting the optimal amount of those things ought to be somewhere between some weighted average of those numbers, and that'll at least give you a rough feeling. Let's say it turns out to be much less than one would expect. So I don't think that works very well. But besides, suppose everybody has an adequate amount of nutrition. Do we all have an adequate amount of education, of entertainment? There are lots of other things people value. A society which you had 90% men and 10% women would strike me as very non-optimal, even if nobody was hungry. All right. So how, in principle, would you define the optimal population?
Like maybe the next person that we add reduces. Well, I'm not going to say this right, but adding one more person
reduces what? You're in the right direction. That's in the interesting direction. You're in the direction which
adding one more person makes everyone worse off, I guess. And
the problem that's a possible criterion. But of course, why aren't we counting the benefits to that person as well?
It would have to be the benefits to that person are less than the total amount.
And in order to define that, you will have to define zero utility.
Right.
Because you have to ask, is the amount by which his happiness is above zero enough to compensate for the rest?
Right.
And the only non-arbitrary definition I can see of zero utility is the suicide point, the point at which you would choose not to exist rather than to exist.
Right.
And if that's your definition, then a different way of putting it is to say, imagine that you have a choice of either society A with world A with 100 million people or world B with 200 million people. And we have a description of how much richer world A is, let's supposing that it were rich, it might not be, but imagine it is. Would you be willing to trade your current position in world one for a coin flip where 50% you end up being a random person in world two, 50% we kill you? Okay, I should go the other way around. 2-1 is the way I should have done this. Say, if we've got 200 million people here and 100 million slots here, then you could say, all right, in order to map these people into these people, you could think about it as an expected utility calculation if you like. And that then gives you an argument for very large populations, which seems unintuitive. The alternative position, the one I thought you were going to give, and the one which is very popular and clearly wrong, is average utility. If people say, what size population is the average happiness in some sense highest? And the reason that's clearly wrong is that you could imagine lowering average happiness without making anybody unhappy. Make some change which affects nobody else, but adds one person who's a little bit less happy than average. That'll bring down the average, but no one is worse off. And that's a point which was made by an economist by the name of Mead a long, long time ago. I invented it too, but he invented it, you know, 20 years earlier or something. People are always stealing me ideas like that. It's really unfair when they do it first. Anyway, so I have an article on what does optimum population mean, and it doesn't really give a clean answer. It just tries to explore the problem. And I think the article's on my webpage, but I'm not sure. It was published in a book.
Is it possible not to have optimal population? I mean, where every person you have actually
increases the benefit to everybody else.
That is certainly, first, it doesn't have to be everybody else, because I'm thinking in the general framework of Marshall's definitions of economic efficiency, not of Pareto. And so the question is, could you have a situation where if the population was bigger, on average, people were better off? And the answer is obviously you could, because a very small population, you're not going to get much division of labor and various other such effects. So clearly you could have a suboptimal population. What's harder to define is a superoptimal population, given the problem of how we compare, of how we judge whether one very happy person is better or worse than two not so happy people. And that's not an easy, to me at least, an easy conceptual problem. Anyway, let me drop all of that stuff, because I hadn't really thought about this when I originally got into this stuff, which was, God, 40 years ago almost. And so the claim is that children produce negative externalities. And the problem is that of the supposed negative externalities, many of them aren't negative. Many of them aren't externalities. And that, like many externality arguments, it ignored the positive externalities. And that the real question is, if when I have a kid, I hurt him by $50 and help you by $60, then I'm having too few kids, not too many, because I've got a net positive externality. And the discussions of these issues generally didn't really think about that side of it. So the one which was just a mistake was to say, look, the world is crowded. You have another kid, that makes the world more crowded, so there's less of everything to go around. And the reason it's a mistake is that most of that everything was private property. So when I have a kid, it doesn't decrease the amount of land you own unless you choose to sell some of it to me or to my kid. The kid is not born with a deed to a per capita share of the world's resources. He's born with nothing except what his parents choose to give him. So if you run it through, imagine that I have an extra kid and he ends up buying some land. Well, one effect is to make the price of land higher. Bad thing for people who are buying land, good thing for people who are selling land. Except for my transaction, every one of those has got one guy on each side, right? So those are going to cancel. Second effect is the person who sold me the land, well, I gave him something else he valued more than the land or he wouldn't have agreed to it, so he's not worse off. So that was just a mistake, except it's a mistake in a framework of private property. It wouldn't be a mistake if you are thinking about national parks or something else, or air, something which either belongs to government or is a commons. Then it could be a possible argument. But a lot of it was made thinking in terms of ordinary private property, and then it's a mistake. Another argument would be, well, my kid may consume goods that produce pollution. He may commit crimes, he may go on welfare, all of those are costs. And another one, which turns out to be quite complicated, is he goes to the public schools, that raises everybody else's school taxes. The problem is that he also is going to end up paying school taxes on average. He's going to end up paying taxes for other kids on welfare. So from that standpoint, what you really have to think about is, on average, when I have a kid, is he contributing more to that set of costs or to that set of benefits? And in the particular case of schooling, if you think about not pairing my taxes with my kid, or not pairing the present generation's taxes with the kids now in school, but pairing the schooling expenses of each kid with the later taxes he pays for schooling other kids, it turns out that they roughly cancel, and the exact which one is larger depends on things like the discount rate and the population growth rate and stuff like that. But as a sort of a rough rule of thumb, each kid is going to roughly pay back in his school taxes what it costs to send to public schools. So that pretty much disappears. And then there are also some other positive externalities, that after all, some of the costs of government don't depend on population size. Maybe they don't. If you think one of the costs is enough defense to keep foreigners from attacking us, bigger population means more people to divide up that expense, so it's an advantage. One of the costs is paying off the national debt. That's a fixed cost. The more people we have, the more taxpayers to pay it off. Other benefits, the more people we have, the more good books will get written, you'd think, everything else being equal. The more medical discoveries, bunch of things you can think of where there are external benefits. And in fact, my first published piece of economics was a pamphlet on the population issues from a sort of a pro-free market standpoint, in which I tried to estimate the externalities. And my conclusion was that I couldn't sign them, that the uncertainties in the size of the effects were large enough that I could not judge whether a random American having a child made other people on net better or worse off. Clearly, some people make it better off. I mean, if I have a child, it makes the world much better off because I produce just wonderful children. They're, you know, sweet, intelligent, affectionate, just the kind of people you want as neighbors. But then there are your children. You know, they may not be so nice. We don't know. And of course, that is really, if you really took this logic seriously, you then get into the rather unpleasant situation of saying, well, we're going to decide who are the people who produce good children, we'll subsidize them, bad children, and tax them. And I'm not sure that's the direction we want to go. But in any case, I want to claim that this is a general problem with externality arguments. That it's, I'm taking the one example that I first got into, but that when people say the government should subsidize X or tax Y or ban Y or produce X, there's a very strong tendency for whoever is making the argument to start out saying, well, I already know this is a good thing. Therefore, let's look for the good, for the positive externalities, and to not think about negative externalities. And if he says, well, I know this is a bad thing, let's take a very simple example, which is arguments on making motorcycle riders wear helmets. All right? And we say, well, look, you know, dying in an accident is a bad thing. We might have to pay for the hospital bills. So therefore, there are negative externalities to your riding without a helmet. So therefore, we can make rules requiring helmets. Anybody like to provide a positive externality from somebody choosing to ride a motorcycle without a helmet? More open, that's right. They call them donor cycles for a reason. It's a kind of accident that's particularly likely to give you a fresh killed body whose organs are still good for transplant. So that's one respect. Anything else? What's the benefit to me if you're dropping dead? Preferably at about 60, 65. That's right. Social Security trust fund's in better shape every time somebody dies just before he starts collecting. Right? Might be. That's tricky because also fewer taxpayers pay for building roads. So that's one of the ones where it's a little hard to know what the net effect is. But my point is only that if you start doing it seriously, you realize that even things that seem unambiguously desirable have negative externalities, and unambiguously bad have positive externalities. So let me take schooling. I shouldn't have written education. I should have written schooling because too often confuse the two. But the question is, if I send my kids to a good school, imagine for a moment, rather than thinking about it in terms of the argument for why the government should subsidize schooling as it now does, suppose we have a world with just private schools. And I want to say there's still too much schooling. We ought to have a special tax on schools. So what are the ways in which my sending my kid to school hurts you or your kid? With the result that I have too high an incentive to do it. What?
We're still talking about just a private school environment.
Yes. I want to take a private school environment for a moment. But the rest of the society as it is.
If you send your kid to school, you're paying for it, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And presumably, if you send your kid to school, that you have X number of more teachers.
That doing that in equilibrium, it might bid up the price of teachers a little bit, but you'd expect that more people can become teachers. That shouldn't be a very big effect. Yeah. What things that I don't like might your kid do with his education? What? What things that I don't like might your kid do with his education? Yeah, we want an example. That's to say he might engage, he might become a con man, he might, you know, start a fraudulent securities firm. In general, insofar as he's getting educated, he's getting better at figuring out how to do stuff. Well, some of the stuff he wants to do is good stuff that we like. Some of it's bad. He might also get better at lobbying government to give him money at my expense. All right? Then on the whole, there's an awful lot, at least, of government transfer payments that aren't going to poor people. They're going to people who are good at getting government to give them transfer payments. Teachers, for example. And professors, I should say. This is a heavily subsidized industry that I'm in. Those would seem to be examples. Let me take a different argument, and one which goes outside the standard economics, but I think is a way in which economics ought to take account of, and at least one economist I know do. And that's that one of the things that really matters to human beings is relative status. All right? And economists are bothered by that. We keep saying, why should we care if the Chinese get rich as long as it doesn't make us any poorer? And yet part of the answer is because we want to believe we're the richest people on earth. And I think if you sort of interrogate your own sort of gut feelings, one of the things you care about is, do I have good things? Another thing you care about is, how well off am I relative to other people? Am I a... And the particular incident which actually brought this whole sort of status point home to me, a few years ago, there's somebody called Eric Raymond, who is one of the active people in the open source movement, if people are familiar with that, with things like Linux and stuff of that sort. And he gave a talk at Stanford, which I attended. And Eric is also a libertarian, and he's somebody, I don't know if I'd met him before, but at least maybe I've corresponded with him or something at some point in the past. Interesting talk, and after the talk, as happens at these talks, people come up around the speaker to talk with him. And I say, hello, I'm David Friedman. He says, David D. Friedman? And I could feel my status in that room shoot up. And I could feel the surge of utility as the status in that room shot up, because here he was the central figure in that particular social group. He'd just given an interesting talk, and he obviously regarded me as somebody who he knew and with respect and so forth. So I didn't get a penny. Well, actually, I did. I got a free Chinese dinner out of it, because people who organized it took him out to dinner, and I was invited along with it. But basically, I got a sizable benefit out of that, of a kind that economists usually ignore. Well, if we think about that, we say, well, what's the result of your educating your kid that your kid does better than my kid, and that my kid feels badly about it? Even if not materially, even if your kid does better in ways which don't make my kid any poorer, still, everybody in the environment we're both in knows that your kid is the star, and mine is just sort of an ordinary kid. Similarly, we're going to be competing for mates. One explanation of why humans care about status is that competition for mates, which is very central to what we evolved to do, which is reproductive success, is a case of a fixed supply. And if there's a fixed supply, then when you get more, I get less, basically. So, anyway... But my point is only that if you take seriously the idea of caring about relative status, now things like schooling become a good deal more ambiguous, because to some extent what you're doing is benefiting yourself at my expense. Now, economists usually think there's too much of that thinking, but all I'm saying is economists do too little while everybody else does too much. Everybody else is too inclined to say, if the rich got richer, the poor must have gotten poorer, which doesn't have to be true, rather... But I'm only saying, if the rich got a lot richer and the poor got a little bit richer, in one relevant dimension the world has improved for everybody, but there's another dimension in which it hasn't, in which the poor really are going to feel like less worthwhile people as a result of that. Now, a different point is that status isn't one-dimensional, because different people care about status with regard to different reference groups. So you could imagine a better designed society in which more nearly everybody's at the top of the ladder, because they're all on different ladders. But that would be a further digression, though I think is an interesting one. I've discussed some of this on my blog if people are curious. All right. Let me now go on to what I think is some interesting economics, namely the case of polygamy. All right. Polygamy, terminology. People often use polygamy to mean multiple wives, but that's wrong. It means either multiple wives or multiple husbands. I'm not sure if it's still polygamy if you have more than one of each, if you have a group marriage of some sort. But that isn't... I don't know of any real-world societies where that was normal, although it certainly occasionally happens in our society, what they refer to as a polyamory is the current term. Polygyny is one husband and two or more wives. Polyandry is one wife and two or more husbands. Polygamy is either... The pattern, if you look at multiple societies, is that monogamy is far and away the most common mating pattern for humans. Polygyny is pretty common, and polyandry exists, but it's pretty rare. Current situation in the U.S. is that polygamy is nominally illegal, but I think it's clear that it occurs, and that as a practical matter, as long as you don't insist on the government recognizing your marriage, you could live with two women if they are willing to live with you in an effectively a marriage, or a woman with two men. And I have reason to believe that I've known indirectly about cases of both of those happening. And one could argue that the sort of standard American marriage pattern is serial polygamy, since you marry a wife, marry to her for a while, divorce her, marry another wife, and so forth. I don't know if any of you paid attention to the case, I guess it was about 2 years ago, I suppose, by now, with the fundamentalist Mormons in Texas, the FLDS, where the Texas Child Protective Services seized 400 children, essentially all the children, from this settlement of fundamentalist Mormons who believed in polygamy, held them for a month or two, like 2 months, made various false claims about them, as it happens. I was paying a good deal of attention. It was an interesting case. And eventually, first the Court of Appeals and then the Supreme Court of Texas unanimously ruled that they had no business holding those children, and they forced them to give them back. But it was an interesting case, and it was clear, I think, if you looked at the news treatment, which was extraordinarily one-sided in the sense of demonstrable lies not being exposed. The particular case that struck me was the authorities announced that they have in their custody 53 women under 18, of whom 31 either are pregnant or have been mothers, thus demonstrating child abuse by the Mormons. The one thing they don't mention in this statement, although they have mentioned it earlier, is that they are refusing to accept birth certificates or driver's licenses as evidence of age. Hence, although they did not explain it, they did not know the age of those women. What they meant was, we have 53 women who we have decided are under 18. By the time the case got through the appeals court in Texas, the 31 women were down to 5. The oldest of the ones that they eventually conceded was an adult was, I think, 27 or 26. That's fraud. I mean, but anyway, if you're sufficiently curious, go look at my old blogs, because I thought it was a fairly outrageous case. But in any case, it was clear in terms of the public treatment that there was a strong bias against people who were openly polygamous and a willingness to believe things about them on little evidence and a lack of skepticism about the other side. At the moment, the situation in Utah, as I understand it, presumably you all know, polygamy was practiced by the Mormons in the early point of their part of their history. There was a series of Supreme Court cases when the federal government outlawed it, and the Mormons lost. In my opinion, the Mormons were right and the other side was wrong. I can't see any basis on the Constitution for the federal government deciding state marriage law, but on the other hand, polygamy was something everybody was against, so therefore you could get the courts to rule it. And eventually, after Utah was occupied by the U.S. Army for a while, the Mormons caved, and they basically announced a new revelation saying that polygamy had been right in the past but was no longer right. Probably for a while they practiced it covertly while it officially didn't, but eventually, and certainly by now, the main body of the Mormon Church is unambiguously opposed to polygamy. However, there were various subgroups of Mormons who didn't accept the new revelation and who, you know, they would say stuck by their religion, and they're still around. The FLDS is one such group. And the situation, as far as I can tell, is that as a practical matter, the state of Utah ignores it. Since, as I say, you know, it's not at all clear it's illegal except in the sense of not being recognized as marriage. And there is now a move by some such people to try to persuade the state of Utah to repeal the laws against polygamy. I don't think it's going to succeed. But it's an interesting case because apparently a bunch of polygamists publicly demonstrated for their cause in Utah, despite the fact that they were confessing to an illegal act, and the basically authorities saying, look, we can't arrest all these people, go home. Anyway, so as an economist, I want to say, what happens if you legalize polygyny or polyandry? And that's two questions, really, two obvious questions. One of them is, are men better off, are women better off? And the other is, on net, are people better off? And the problem with analyzing this question is that it's complicated. And my preferred analysis simplifies away a bunch of the complications so I can use standard economics. And after we do that, I want to think a little bit about putting those complications back in, because it is clearly losing something. But think of marriage as a perfectly ordinary market, where husbands are looking for wives, wives are looking for husbands. one of the implicit assumptions on ordinary marketable supply and demand curves is that the products are fungible, that, you know, one bushel of wheat is like another, so we're going to ignore the fact that really the woman who's right for me isn't right for you, and the woman who's right for you isn't right for me. We might come back to that later. For the moment, just think of an ordinary market, and then there's a price on that market. And what is that price? It's implicit in the terms of marriage. So that if I marry a woman and the understanding is that she'll have a job, and when she comes home from her job, she'll cook dinner and wash clothes and take care of the baby and all the rest of it, that's a case where the price of a wife is very low and the price of a husband is very high, because she's agreeing to terms very favorable to me and unfavorable to her. Reverse that. And imagine that the understanding is that when we're married, I'll earn all of the money and cook half the dinners and hire a nanny so she doesn't have to work very hard to take care of the baby. Now the price of a wife is high, the price of a husband is low. Does that make sense as a way of thinking about it? And you can see that the higher the price of a wife, the more women willing women are to be married, because the better the terms of marriage are for them, and the less willing men are to marry them. So it looks just like an ordinary market, where as price goes, if you can describe it either as the husband market or the wife market, it doesn't matter except how you graph it. But if I think about it as a man, I think of it as the wife market. I want to buy a wife, and I then say, if as the price of wives go up, the demand for wives goes down, the quantity demanded goes down, rather. The more favorable to women the terms of marriage are, the fewer men want to get married. And the quantity supplied of wives goes up, because the more favorable the terms are, the more willing women are to get married. That makes sense it's clearly a simplification. We use simplification to see the logic of some part of the problem, basically. So now, what happens when you legalize polygyny? It is now legal for a man to marry two wives. What's the effect on that market?
We have a market. Price. Quantity. And this is the wife market. Draw it that way around. And we have a demand for wives, which goes like that. Low price, lots of men want to get married, high price, hardly anybody does. And we've got a supply for wives that goes like that. And at the moment, that's equal to real price and quantity. Okay? Any ordinary price. What happens when you legalize polygyny?
The quantity of wives goes down.
Quantity of wives go down.
There's less wives on the market.
Total number of wives out there is the same. Supply will be down. I don't see the supply going down. I would say the demand goes up.
Well, more men were buying multiple wives.
What that means is not this is number of wives, not number of marriages. So the number of wives out there is still the same. But some men can now buy more than one wife. So therefore the demand curve for wives is shifted out. Because remember, the demand curve shows as a function of price. And we have to think a little bit about what price means in the case of a polygynous marriage. But the answer is that if we think about what the price in terms of what the wife is getting, then if I am paying the same price per wife for two wives as you're paying for one, that means I'm offering my two wives terms sufficiently attractive so they're indifferent between being my wife on those terms or being your wife on the existing terms. Makes sense as a way of saying the same price. So now what happens is, if the price stayed the same, then everybody who before wanted to marry one wife would want to marry at least one. And some people who before wanted to marry one wife, those who could afford it, would say, well, now it's legal to marry two. So that means that the demand curve for wives would be shifting home. Right? You can think of it like that. Remember, this is showing quantity of wives. We graph things a little differently if I was showing quantity of husbands, although the logic ends up being exactly the same. So if the demand curve shifts out, and the price goes up. What's happening, in effect, is that the men who want one wife now have to bid not only against the other men who want one wife, but against the man who wants a second wife as well. So that's going to bid up the price. So that means that women who get one husband, which probably most of them will still do in most polygamous societies, most couples are still monogamous, are going to have to treat her a little bit better in order to, because essentially this is the, he's bidding against more competition, whereas somebody with more than one wife will have to treat them well enough so that they choose to marry him on those terms rather than someone else. So it's a neat case where the natural instinct is to say that polygyny hurts women because they say, look, you're going to be dividing the man's time and wealth and so forth with another wife. But the economic argument, so far at least, seems to say, no, that was implicitly assuming that we froze the price, but we don't freeze the price. And therefore, it actually benefits them. And here's the argument. What's the net effect? Women are better off because the woman with one husband has him on better terms. The woman with half a husband, it's half a husband who's offering, maybe he's very rich or something, he's offering her, or maybe he's just very nice, or really good at making love. Doesn't matter what the characteristics are. However it is, he's offering her terms so that she's willing to accept half of him instead of all of someone else. At the higher price, more women get married. So some women who couldn't find a husband at terms that they liked before now can. So women are better off. Monogamous men are unambiguously worse off because they're still getting one wife, but they got to treat her better than before. Polygynous men, it's ambiguous because they're getting two wives, which they prefer to one, but two wives at a high price per wife instead of one wife at a lower price. So it's as if somebody said, you know, instead of limiting you to one computer, we'll let you own two computers, but by the way, we're also driving up the price of computers 50%. Well, if I bought two computers, I might say, well, look, I'd rather have had one if I could have gotten it at the old price, but since I can't, and I'm allowed to have two, I'll have two. I'd prefer to have two at the old price, but that's not an option, and similarly here. However, in terms of economic efficiency, the net effect has to be a gain, because the men's loss, namely paying a higher price, is exactly balanced by women's gains, because they're receiving the higher price. And there's the additional gain for the men who now have two wives, where they prefer having two wives at a given price to having one wife at that price. Legalizing polyandry, same thing the other direction, helps men, hurts women, and creates a net efficiency. So that's sort of, at least to me, that's sort of an interesting result. Let's now step back a little bit and look at relevant things about how we've simplified our model, because that's something you do a lot in economics. First, I'm assuming that women own themselves. If, as in many societies, whether you get to marry a woman is decided by her father or her brother or her family in general, then it might well be that exactly the same thing happens, except that the price isn't paid to the woman in better treatment, it's paid to the father in higher bride price. So in that case, the economics are still the same, but the actual implications are rather different. And as I say, if instead of talking about the marriage market, talking about the automobile market, the argument would be obvious. We said nobody's allowed to own more than one car. That decreases total demand for cars. Abolishing that law would benefit sellers of cars. Hurt buyers of one car might or might not help buyers of two cars. Is the argument clear in that case? But there are then a bunch of other complications which I don't think can be dealt with nearly as easily. And one of them is the sorting problem, and I don't really have a good way of modeling that, but it's obviously important, the fact that before I get to sorting, because let me do the one which I do know the answer to, and then I'll go to the one which I don't answer. The one I think I do know the answer to is, suppose we change two of our assumptions. First, we assume that marriage contract terms are not enforceable, so that you marry somebody, and even if your husband says, I'll earn all the money and cook half the meals, you come home, and if you don't cook the meals, you don't get dinner. All right, so don't have a good way of enforcing the terms of that contract. So we can imagine a case, let's also assume that the legal rules are such that you can't have a price before the contract.
You can imagine a system where we can't enforce the terms of the contract, but when you get married, the man pays the woman a dowry. The woman has control over that dowry, so she's better off and he's worse off. But assume that away as well. So assume that, in effect, there is no way of doing price competition. But the other assumption we're going to make is that people vary in quality considered as spouses. And the simplification I'm going to retain is to assume that everybody evaluates quality in the same way. So I'm going to imagine that you, considered as a husband, are a level 82 husband. And he's an 87, and he's only a 53, and I'm only a 14. And similarly for all the wives, potential wives. All right. So we're going to assume that, so that means that the only thing I can bid with is my own quality. All right? That if a woman has to choose between a level 57 quality husband or a 43 quality husband, choose the 57 every time. But the 43 doesn't have the option of saying, well, I know that, you know, I'm not as nice a guy to live with, but on the other hand, I'll wash all the dishes. Because she knows that he'll renege on that contract once they're married. Probably also want to assume no divorce, because otherwise when they renege on the contract, you leave. What's going to happen if you just imagine trying to set that up as a formal model? What's going to happen in that world? How are people going to get matched up?
Well, assuming there are a standard curve of both men and women.
I don't know what equal means because they've got different qualities, right?
Right. But presumably, whatever your ranking is as a 43, you should be matched up with a woman of the same ranking.
You're now making...
You were to rank all of the men.
That's it. That's right. You're now, instead of making the ranking a measure of quality, it's a measure of where in the order you are.
Right.
That's right. So the number one, the most attractive man, gets the most attractive woman, whatever the definitions of attractive are, because who can compete with him? Second gets a second, third gets the third, fourth gets the fourth, and so forth. Right. And now, when you introduce polygyny in that society, now it gets more complicated. Because now the first most attractive man might get the first most attractive woman, but he might say, no, I'm willing to settle for numbers 23 and 24 instead. All right? So in that case, the high attractiveness women are likely to lose out through the introduction of polygyny. All right, because now the lower attractiveness women can compete with them by offering two instead of one. The low attractiveness women are likely to gain because now with more of the high attractiveness women pulled off the market by marrying two, more of the medium sort of level, the people near the women near the bottom of the scale now can find husbands because some of the women who the men a little bit higher up, or maybe at the bottom, depending on relative numbers of men and women, would have married, have now gone to some really good husband as second wife. So you could actually, if you're curious, in my price theory text, which is webbed and linked to my page, I actually do a more formal version than I'm doing here of trying to model it. And really, part of the fun of it is seeing how same real world situation, which we're all familiar with. It's complicated enough that you can't really expect to analyze a full description of it. So you try different cuts of saying, well, one feature about what's going on is the price, because after all, we're pretty sure that if women are in short supply, men are going to have to treat them better to get them. We know that marriages differ in what the division of responsibilities are and so forth. So let's suppose that's what's doing it, analyze it that way. Interesting, clean set of results. But a different thing that's going on is difficult even enforcing contracts, and what you're really looking for is not the woman who offers you the highest price, but the woman you find most desirable of the ones who will have you, basically. And desirable might mean the hottest woman. It might also mean the one who you think would make a good mother for your children, the one who you think won't cheat on you. You could imagine a whole lot of other criteria other than the ones that naturally occur to an adolescent man looking at a sexy woman. Then the third version, which you are welcome to try to model if you like, but I don't think I have a very good one, although it maybe it's the most important of all, is the sorting problem. That if you say, look, here, the woman who's just the right woman for me, you wouldn't want to be married to. And the woman who's just the right woman for you, I wouldn't want to be married to. That, you know, when I, after my first marriage broke up, I did some serious thinking about what do I need. and it was clear that I had a set of characteristics, not mainly physical, sort of interesting. One of the things I tend to do just to pass the time is observe passing women and try to analyze what are my physical criteria. What are the reasons that this woman looks sexy to me and that woman doesn't? And it's not nearly as simple as, you know, young, pretty kinds of things. That's part of it. But there are particular body types which I approve of, not aesthetically, but sort of gut level. And particular personality types, ditto, which I approve of, gut level. And on the whole, I would have to say that my present wife, with whom I have been very happily married now for something over 20 years, pretty close on personality type, not terribly close on physical body type. I think my first wife probably comes closer to being the kind of woman who physically strikes me as that's the kind of woman I want to go to bed with than my second wife, but she was a much less satisfactory wife for me. And she has been happily married to her second husband, who I am sure would have been an unsatisfactory husband for my second wife, and she seems to be a very satisfactory wife for him. So there's a real sorting element in there. And potentially, of course, the internet is the solution to these problems. If only somebody can work out the right algorithms to say, here is a list of 50 questions for each of you. By the answer to those, we can tell, aha, you go with her. You go with her. If you could really do that, you could make the world a much better place and incidentally make yourself $1 billion. But as far as I know, although there are lots of efforts, I don't think any of them work at least that well. How well they work, I don't know. I did have a friend who met his wife through computer dating, but they eventually got divorced, so I don't know if that counts as a success or not. So anyway, I will leave to those of you that are inclined to sort of wrestle with hard mathematical kinds of problems, how you would formally model that sorting problem, and what non-obvious conclusions you would get out of it. Alright. I think I'm actually going to finish early, but maybe you could think of some other things to talk about. The one other thing I wanted to talk about, which is not really especially about this chapter just gives an example of it, is the misleading way in which time sometimes comes into economic arguments. There are some economic arguments where we're really talking about time. The interest rates, say, are, you know, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, present value, all that stuff is real time. But we also often say, suppose we abolish the law against polygyny, what would happen? And that isn't really what we mean. That's what we say because it's an easy way to think about it. But if we really abolished the law against polygyny and had to, we'd say, well, wait a minute, what do we assume happens to the already married couples? Do we assume that each wife gets to renegotiate the terms of her marriage given the increased demand for wives? Do we assume that everybody gets divorced and we then start over again? That would be sort of a very messy situation. What we really mean by abolishing polygyny, laws against polygyny, suppose we had abolished laws against polygyny 1,000 years ago, or at least 80 years ago, long enough so that there were no marriages currently existing made under that rule, how would the world be different? So change from A to B is put as a sequence in time, but it's really a parallel universe model. It's really, if we were in a world which did A instead of a world which did B, what would the differences be? And that's a point which doesn't get made often enough. I've really run out of what I was going to say, but if you don't have other things to say, I can go back and say a little bit more about one of the points we were discussing, namely how you would compare populations. So let me first see, are there things we've been discussing? I think we've basically finished our family stuff that you'd like to say more about.
We were talking earlier about the concept of having 2 million people in 1 million slots.
Right.
How do we choose who, presuming to argue whether the 1 million is a better thing,
yep,
depends on the value that the first person places. So in a situation where a million people say yes and a million, yep, people say no, I wouldn't, yep, get places.
Let me go back for a moment to an old argument for a version of utilitarianism. And this is some of you may have heard about Rawls, who was a famous political philosopher for reasons I've never understood. But somebody else made an argument which was like his, except he got it right, in my opinion, earlier than Rawls, and I forget the name, but some other philosopher. And he said, he wasn't worried about different population sizes. He's saying we're just trying to imagine two alternative populations of the same size. Is there an interesting conceptual way in which we can say which one is better? And he says, well, imagine that you were going to be put in one of those societies, randomly allocated among the slots in that society. So we imagine that in society A, there are a million lives that are going to be led. Society B, there are a million lives that are going to be led. And we are going to have you behind what Rawls called a veil of ignorance, where you're saying you know all about those lives. The one little detail you don't know is which one you're going to lead. So we're going to say, seems a reasonable way to assume it, that you've got one chance in a million of being each of those people. And we will then say the society you would choose in that situation is the better one. Now that has an obvious problem of who is you. And somehow, because this is before you get to be one of these people, you've got to somehow be some kind of an abstracted person. Well, if you really believe in utility, if you're willing to think of utility as a real thing, it makes sense, because you say, what are you behind the veil of ignorance? You're a utility maximizer. So you say, well, if I was that person, how happy I would be? If I was that person, how happy I would be? The standard modern way of looking at utility is in terms of an expected value kind of calculation, where we say the utility of a lottery, you get by getting the utility of the outcomes and averaging across the lottery. That's what von Neumann added to I don't think I've discussed this in class. Let me mention it. It's sort of interesting. Prior to about 1930 or so, people who thought seriously about the idea of utility thought of it as only an ordinal and not a cardinal measure. Where an ordinal measure is, we can say, this outcome has more utility than that, but there's no meaning for what it has, for how much more it has. All right. And what von Neumann did, along with inventing game theory and many other things, was to show that if individual choices under uncertainty met certain consistency requirements, which I can't give you a list of because I've forgotten it, that you could then assign a utility to every outcome such that when you were faced with an uncertain outcome, you would always choose the uncertain outcome among different uncertain outcomes, the lottery, which had the highest expected value of utility. So now that means that we now have a quantitative measure, because we can now say not only is A better than B, A is better than B by more than C is better than D. And why do we know that? Because you would rather have a choice of, you'd rather have a 50-50 chance of A and of D than of B and C. I don't know if you follow that. If you work it through, you end up with a quantitative sense. It's still arbitrary in terms of the unit. You still don't know whether, if you scaled everything by 100, it would still be the same. But it's just bounded linear transformations for the mathematicians in the room, so it's much less arbitrary than it was before. If you think in those terms, it then makes sense to say, all right, what's the average utility of being in the society? It's the utility to you of having one chance in a million of being each life in that society. And now we have, some people might argue, a justification for utilitarianism if you think of hypothetical choice as having some moral standing by saying, look, everybody behind the veil of ignorance would choose the society over that one, not knowing who they would be. And that's, see, I forget the name of the philosopher who made the argument. I think it's Arsanyi, I think. That sounds right. I think it's Arsanyi. Rawls' version, which has always seemed crazy to me, was to say, in effect, behind the veil of ignorance, you don't have any probabilities. And you would therefore act as if you were sure you'd be in the worst slot. And I can see no more reason to be sure you're in the worst slot than to be sure you're in the best slot. And yet, he built a whole sort of political philosophy out of that assumption. To assume that any benefit to people who were above the bottom had to be justified as providing net benefits to those at the bottom, because only maximizing the worst off person's welfare mattered. That seems insane to me. A lot of people were impressed by it. Don't know why. Anyway, so if we start from there, if we're willing to sort of think of the blank utility maximizer behind the veil, we can then say, all right, we've got another version of this. In this version, we've got a million slots here and 2 million slots here. These are alternative futures. And you have a choice of either one chance in a million of being each of these people. Sorry, of either one chance in 2 million of being each of these people, or one chance in 2 million of being each of these million people, which means that half the time you're nobody. Does that make sense? So if you're thinking in terms of something like which society maximizes total utility, it makes some sense to do it that way. But then if you work that through, and if you think of zero as the suicide point, you say that's going to be attractive. That's going to make very large societies look very good. It looks as though that says if we have the choice between America as it is now or in America with the standard of living of India and 900 billion people in it, we pick the latter every time because would you choose two chances out of three of dying in order to maintain an American standard of living and an Indian standard of living? You know, most of us wouldn't. All right. So I actually had a conversation with a woman who was a colleague of mine a long time ago. I was teaching at UCLA and who later was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors and is currently married to a very famous economist who I won't name. And she said that she was unsure whether the present value of utility at birth was positive or negative. And my conclusion, which I think was true, was that she had had a much less pleasant life than I had. Because I have no doubt at all that average over my lifetime, I'm glad it happened. But she didn't feel that way. And as long as most people feel that way, then the definition that I've just given would give you a strong preference for the larger population. And in my article on this, I try to sketch out something that does a little better than that. And what I'm sketching out is something where basically we have a criterion by which we can say that the larger population is better, which is the one I've... No. By which we can say that the smaller population is better, which is the one I've just given you. The smaller population is better if the average level is so much higher that people would accept the relevant risk of non-existence in order to be in it. We then have a different criterion for going the other direction, and then we have a bunch of cases in between which we can't compare. And that was the best I could manage, and I don't know of anybody having gotten any further with that problem since. Most people at the time assumed that average utility was the right criterion, although they didn't always put it that way. And as I say, Mead, who's a moderately prominent economist, had shown why that was wrong a long time ago. His example, which is not identical to mine, but the same principle, was imagine a world with two cities. And they're both prosperous cities full of happy people. But A is a little bit better off than B. They have essentially nothing to do with each other. There's a river in between. Do we really want to say that a plague that painlessly killed everybody in B would be a good thing? It would raise the average utility. People in A are a little happier than in B. Eliminate B, the average goes up. And yet that surely is crazy. And that was his argument. I think he's right. One of my examples was to, I was making it national, and I was saying a child borns, grows up, and dies in Washington, D.C. And we observe that he's a bit less happy than the average American. And we say, aha, that lowered the average utility of America, so he shouldn't have existed. Until we discover that his father was the janitor for the Indian ambassador, hence the place in Washington he was born, lived, and grew up was in India, legally speaking. Extraterritoriality. Hence, we've got to count him in the Indian population instead of the American population, and he was above the average for India, and therefore made the world a better place. And then the next example was, imagine somebody who by some impossible sequence of events is born, grows up, and dies on a desert island. Do we really want to say that whether he should exist depends on the condition of the rest of the world which he never meets? Because after all, if we say, well, happens this Robinson Crusoe figure lives a pretty happy but not really happy life. If the rest of the world is really happy, he brought down the average. If the rest of the world is pretty miserable, he brought up the average. How can that determine whether it's a good thing that he lived? And those were the arguments that I offered originally before I read Mead and discovered he'd beaten me to it.
Is there any sort of calculation for how, like, for relativity, like,
what do you mean?
For example, if I don't know what a poor society looks like, let's say that I grew up during the time of, I don't know, plague or terrible war or something.
Yep.
I mean...
Yes. I mean, what you're saying is that perhaps one of the things that determines how happy people are is not the absolute, but some kind of a relative standard. And no, that I agree. I wasn't discussing that. That's a very interesting question. And that I remember I had a friend from high school, who I knew thereafter, who went on to do graduate work in anthropology. And she spent some time living in, I think, Central America, with a tribe of Indians sufficiently isolated so that she thought she was the second non-native speaker of their language ever. And her impression was they didn't seem to be much less happier than the people she knew in America, and yet they were, you can imagine, a historical sequence in which generation by generation they get better off. And every generation, you know, the people say, boy, isn't this much better than when I was a kid. At the end of the time, they're us. At the beginning, they're the they knew, and there's been this huge improvement, and yet, same about as happy. So yes, there has been modern happiness research, which I don't trust very much, because the obvious problem of how do you ask somebody how happy he is, how do you get a uniform scale, which claims at least that certain, I think the result is that real income does have some effect on happiness for societies. But there seems to be a lot of debate about what the real results of that are, and sort of gets politically loaded about what you should want and so forth. So no, I agree that there's sort of the economist, as it were, assumes that the people's utility function is the same, and that what varies is how much of what they want they get, and the more of what they want they get, the happier they are. The anthropologist might not implausibly say that's wrong. The utility function really changes, depends on where you grew up and what your circumstances were and so forth. I don't have a good answer for that. That is to say, it might be that this is a suicide rate or the suicide point. The suicide rate, first, is going to depend at least somewhat on what people think happens to you when you die. That if people believe that committing suicide sends you to hell, that's a strong reason not to go to commit suicide, even if life seems pretty much like hell already. But aside from that, again, that would tell you how many people were below zero, but it wouldn't tell you how much above the rest of them were, what you'd like to know. You know, maybe someday we'll have the tools by which we can somehow measure how, you know, plug something into somebody's neck and measure happiness. Or what would be not, I don't think it's doable, but maybe more doable than that. If you could really do a good job of recording somebody's mind, if you could say somehow all of the stuff going on inside your head that amounts from your standpoint to how you feel, we could tape record. And then play it back for somebody else. And he can say, when I was you for a day, was I happier or less happy than I usually am for a day? And I don't think that's going to be doable. My guess is it's going to turn out that the nature of consciousness is more complicated than that. But that's sort of as close as I can come to seeing how you could really do it. Well, you do, of course, have cases of people who've lived in different societies, and they can have at least some opinion from their standpoint of how happy they seem to be. Anyway, I think we're over our time.